Hello to everyone in the United States, Israel, Palestine, and other places throughout the world. Welcome to this latest installment of Conversations with Israel and Palestine, hosted by Partners for Progressive Israel. Conversations with Israel and Palestine is a series of informational webinars that bring voices from Israel and Palestine to an American and other audiences, providing an important link between progressives in the US and in the Middle East. My name is Lenny Grob, and I'm a vice president of Partners for Progressive Israel. And before I hand it over to today's discussion moderator, let me note that Partners for Progressive Israel is an American not-for-profit organization dedicated to the achievement of a durable and just peace between Israel and its neighbors, and believes in the need to ensure civil rights, equality, and social justice for all of Israel's inhabitants. Partners seeks to deepen Americans' understanding of Israel's complexities so that they can better advocate for a progressive Israeli future. Right now, Partners for Progressive Israel's main focus is preventing Israel's unilateral annexation of occupied territory. And we invite everyone to visit the Stop Annexation Now page on our website. I also want to mention that we have two co-sponsors for this session. Americans for Peace Now, I think is a name familiar to most of you, and Meretz UK, which is a British not-for-profit organization, independent yet affiliated with the left-wing Meretz Party in Israel. It's committed to achieving peace between Israel and its neighbors. It applies similar principles of equality, civil rights, gender rights, and communal cohesion within Britain. The organization enjoys close ties to the Jewish labor movement and other progressive Jewish groups. It runs meetings of a political, cultural, and educational nature open to all and features speakers from Israel, Palestine, Britain, Egypt, and the USA. Now let me introduce our moderator, Shaked Morag. Shaked has served as the executive director of Shalom Achshav, Peace Now in Israel, for the past 2 years. During that time, she has presided over Peace Now's campaigns on the nation state law, and most recently, of course, is leading the fight to prevent annexation. Before joining Shalom Achshav, she served in senior positions in the Meretz Party, including as the party's interim secretary general. So take it away, Shaked.
Thank you so much, Lenny. As Lenny said, I'll be serving as the discussion moderator of the, over the next 60 minutes. We'll try to divide it in a way that for the first about 40 minutes, I'll be posing the questions to the panelists, and I will introduce them soon. But after that, we'll all be answering questions from the video audience for the last 20 minutes. So I really encourage you all to type in your questions at any time. All you need to do is look at the bottom of your monitor for the icon that reads Q&A. You may need to touch your screen or run your mouse over it, and then click on this icon and type your question in the small box that appears. The webinar won't disappear or be disrupted. Don't worry, please note that your microphones are turned off, so questions can be only asked via this way. So please don't hesitate and write your question down. And let me now introduce our two panelists for today that will be answering these questions and sharing with us their views on annexation and the situation. We have with us Dear Ambassador Dr. Hussam Zomlot, who is the head of the Palestinian mission to the United Kingdom. Prior to this appointment to the UK, Dr. Zomlot served as ambassador to the United States, as the head of the PLO General Delegation to the United States, and strategic affairs advisor to the Palestinian president. Dr. Zomlot's previous official roles include also serving as ambassador at large for the Palestinian presidency and as director of Fatah Foreign Relations Commission. Dr. Zomlot holds a PhD in economics from the University of London, was a professor of strategy and public policy at Birzeit University, where he co-founded and chaired Birzeit School of Government and held a number of teaching and research positions at Harvard University and at the University of London. His professional experience includes working as an economist at the United Nations and an economic researcher with the London School of Economics and the Palestine Policy Research Institute. Dr. Zomlot is married and has three children, some of which I've seen earlier, really cute. Hi, Dr. Zomlot. Hello. Our other very dear panelist is Ambassador, retired, Ilan Baruch, who was until recently the policy advisor to the chairperson of Meretz. In March 2011, Baruch resigned from Israel's Ministry of Foreign Affairs on grounds of principle after a 36-year diplomatic career. It included overseas posting in Asia, Europe, and Africa, and a number of high coalition postings. Founder of the Palestinian Autonomy Department, head of coordination of the multilateral peace process, and head of the Middle East Division for Economic Cooperation. He was also a team member of the Israeli delegation to the Oslo Peace Interim Accords negotiations and participated in various negotiations with the Palestinian Authority, Jordan, and Egypt on economic agreements. Ilan Baruch's last posting overseas was ambassador of Israel to South Africa, as well as Namibia, Botswana, and Zimbabwe. Since his last retirement, Baruch has been devoting his time and experience to projects in public diplomacy and occasionally contributes columns of policy advocacy in different media outlets in Israel and abroad. Ilan Baruch is currently the chairperson of Policy Group, Working Group, a team of activists devoted to promoting a Middle East peace process based on the two-state paradigm. Baruch is also an editorial board member of the Palestine-Israel Journal and co-founder of a new cultural center startup, the Palestine House in Tel Aviv. So hello, dear Ilan. And I'd like to open with the same question for the two of you. Dr. Zomlot will go first. I'd like to ask you, we are gathering here because of the issue of annexation. Why is it so dangerous? What is so bad and grave about annexation? Really, a few minutes from your point of view, why is it so urgent that we are gathered here discussing this? Please.
Before that, Sheikh, allow me to really express my gratitude for the America Peace Now, for the Meretz UK, for the partners, for Progressive Israel, and for you and for all the people who have joined us, because this is a major thing at a very important time in our history. And I think out of impeding annexation comes also people together, and it brings movements together, and we see this happening everywhere. You mean by that question maybe the term that has been used by several people, including us, the Palestinians, that annexation poses existential threat. And let me first, from the very outset, clarify this point. It does not pose an existential threat on the people of Palestine, the cause of Palestine. I mean, there is no such a thing as an existential threat on 13 million people. Once a journalist asked me recently, what if Israel does to you what it did in 1948? What if a wholesale transfer happens, ethnic cleansing, they send you in buses off east? What happens? I told them nothing will happen. We will just become a diaspora agency and a liberation movement from outside. And I reminded the journalist that actually that's exactly what we were before 1993. So the existential part is about the two-state solution. It's a threat, an existential threat on the two-state solution, not on the people of Palestine or the cause of Palestine, and for that matter, for the cause of peace and justice, because there are so many other forms of solutions in the future. In the future, there would be so many other ways of manifesting justice and legality. It's not just the two-state solution. However, the annexation is an imminent existential threat on the very notion of partition. It is not secret, and I will try to be brief, that for Netanyahu, it serves three functions, three purposes. The first is personal. It simply has allowed him to be re-elected, to dodge criminal charges. He wants to be big and take big decisions. By the way, I am hearing from so many people, especially in America, who interact with Netanyahu. He's obsessed about, in a way, being the one who erected the second Israel. The second Israel is a greater Israel, Israel from the river to the sea. And I don't want to dwell on this, but most likely he will not be remembered as that. He will be remembered as the one who ended the first Israel. He will be remembered as the one who has really undermined the first Israel that tried to be, in a way or another, a semi-democracy. But there is a political function for this whole annexation, and there is a strategic function. The political function is a diversion, because all of us are up in arms about annexation, focusing on annexation, and almost feeling like should Israel pause and postpone or cancel annexation, it will be rewarded. I mean, so already Netanyahu has managed, by focusing on this issue, to divert the attention from issues that he does not want to discuss, which is practically the end of occupation, the cessation of the settlement expansion, and all that you know of the real issues on the ground. And nobody is talking to Netanyahu and to the Israeli government about these real issues. Everybody is pressuring to stop, prevent annexation, which is important. It must be prevented, but it did serve that political. Strategically, annexation for Netanyahu would simply preempt any possibility of a two-state solution, any possibility of a Palestinian state. Now, I don't want to go much further, Shakib, but the map for us is very clear. The moment the Israeli government announced that it intends to annex on the 17th of May last month, we immediately absolved ourselves of all agreements signed. Why? Because that commitment by this wide coalition government means that Israel has absolved itself of all agreements, because the crux of these agreements is negotiating towards a two states on the 1967 borders. It was in the Oslo Declaration of Principles that this would be based on UN Security Council resolutions 242338. In Oslo, Israel reversed its decisions and its annexation of East Jerusalem, because it accepted that Jerusalem is a final status issue. It is up for the negotiations of the two sides based on the international framework. In Oslo, Israel also accepted other five permanent status issues, including borders, settlements, refugees, and what have you. Therefore, the declaration of annexation is a reversal of the reverse, i.e. Israel went back 180 degrees to reverse its decision to put all these issues on the table. And that's why, legally speaking, we had to. It was not a threat or a reaction. It was a legal act, because it doesn't make sense that you actually commit to agreements that the other side has just nullified. The second part is, should Israel go ahead with implementation? And we are clear. We are as clear as it can ever be. Should Israel go ahead in implementing annexation, be it 1 centimeter or be it the entire West Bank? And by the way, what they're talking about is the entire West Bank. Go back to the ultimate deal, the Trump deal. Israel has the overall security control from the river to the sea. It doesn't matter if they annex parts of the West Bank here and there, but effectively it is the annexation of the entire West Bank. Be it the whole West Bank or 1 centimeter, it's about the principle. Should 1 centimeter be annexed, and I represent here officially the Palestine Liberation Organization, the Palestinian leadership, and of course the Palestinian people, read my lips, that will spell for us an announcement by Israel of the end of the two-state solution paradigm. And therefore, our actions will be as it was when they announced, it will be immediate. we will give back full responsibility of the occupied people and land back to Israel, and we will go back to the pre-1993 dynamics. This is not to abandon the platform, but this is to abandon the mechanisms that Israel has been using for the last 27 years to sustain the status quo. And this is to go back to reorganize, regroup, re-energize, not only us, the Palestinians, us and you, and that we witnessed what happened in Tel Aviv only recently, the protests against annexation. We are seeing what is happening in the US, and only today, 189 members of the Congress signing a letter against the annexation and against the Israeli policies. We are witnessing in Europe here and in the UK, the great opposition that is happening. So it's just a call for regrouping, reorienting, taking a breath and see how can we go further. With that, I end that there's much to add later on the discussion.
Thank you so much for this very direct speech. I am looking forward to ask you some questions, but first I want to hear the introductory part by Mr. Baruch. Can you please give us some another angle of this, maybe the Israeli point of view? Why is annexation so dangerous for Israel?
Yes, well, I need to make sure that our audience is not thinking that I in any way represent the government of Israel here. I'm very much on the side of opposing government policies, and this is the reason why I'm here today, and I'm very grateful to the organizers and also to Sam for his introductory remarks. We talk about no less than a dramatic change of the game. It's an annexation by Israel of Palestinian territory, regardless of size. Even 1 inch would be a paradigm change. We have been living in sort of an uncomfortable coexistence with the Palestinians on the premise that occupation will change into a settlement through a negotiated peace agreement. And annexation, even though it is pretended to be part of an American designed redraw of future relations between Israel and Palestine, it is actually a one-sided, unilateral act of designing the future in a way that removes once and for all any option for a Palestinian opportunity for self-determination. And this is very dangerous for Israel itself, for a reason I would like to articulate in a minute. But it is also dangerous for any future relations between Israelis and Palestinians and Israel and the Middle East. I can see a catastrophic result of annexation by the way of fragmentation in Jordan, for example, a threat to the Hashemite house, waves of violence in the region beyond Jordan, and within Israel-Palestine. Violence is a possibility that we need to take into account. And so we think that we and my group, myself, that annexation is a very irresponsible move forward by a government that actually is looking at its own narrow agenda. And I have different views on that from Hussam. I think Netanyahu is squarely motivated by ideology. And the ideology Netanyahu is leading is designed to defeat the Palestinians, not only on the ground, but also the narrative, the Palestinian narrative that needs to have a space alongside our narrative, but is the objective of the Netanyahu government for destruction. And this, where does it take us? Let me tell you, I was for 3 years assigned to South Africa, 10 years after the grand transformation, paradigm transformation, if you want, from apartheid into democracy. In apartheid South Africa, there were, for each white person, there were five or six black people with no future, no rights, no privilege. The whites were running a fairly liberal democracy in South Africa with a relatively speaking free press, with a parliament that was operating, and with everything that looked like a democratic Western society, regardless of the vast population of black people that had no share in this. If we go for annexation, and Palestine is then rendered into a Bantustan-like set of conglomerate of small spaces with no full control of, we will find ourselves in an apartheid situation. As of now, on the West Bank, for each and every settler, there are five or six Palestinians with no rights. You know, the settler community and politicians are very proud to say that there are 600,000 settlers in the West Bank and they could not be removed. But they tend to forget that there are 2.5 million Palestinians. And unless they are being removed by force, they have no intention to go anywhere. They are there. And not only that this is a horrendous future for the Palestinians, a future with no future, it is also a black future for us Israelis, because a society that is exercising injustice on a scale, on a magnitude, that reminds us of apartheid South Africa, has no future. It's unsustainable. And I am looking from a distance on all of this. People need to understand that Palestine actually should have been given an opportunity for independence and statehood and self-determination in the course of time that we call decolonization. Like Ghana or Nigeria, Palestine should have been a country with no domination by anyone else but by the Palestinians themselves. It so happened that the case of Palestine was different to the endless number of countries. You know, we tend to forget the UN General Assembly in November 47 included only 56 countries. Today, it is 193 countries. The difference between the two is decolonization. And in this period of decolonization, Palestine should have been already an independent state, maybe 50, 60, 70 years. It didn't happen. And today, I think the dealing with annexation should take us to the point where we are looking at new ways to make it possible for Palestine to become Palestine, a separate, independent, viable state in where Palestinians reside and exercise self-determination. If you want, we can use the language of decolonization and say that Palestine needs to be liberated. Very unfortunately, it needs to be liberated from us. And I can tell you that in Israel, you and I, Shaked, and others, there is a constituency. There is a substantial constituency that is ready and prepared to take part in any future quest to see Palestine break the yoke of Israeli domination and begin to bloom as a separate independent state. We need for that the international community. And this is why I was so thrilled to be part of this webinar, because I'm investing myself day and night in talking to the third party in this game, the international civil society. And this is the job Hussam is exercising as ambassador of Palestine in London. And this is a job I'm exercising as a player in the Israeli civil society of activists who are capable of reaching out to the international community. We have been witnessing these days a fantastic project born in Israel. Few former members of Knesset wrote a letter, a petition to hundreds and hundreds of members of parliament in Europe. 1,080 parliamentarians in Europe, European Parliament and national parliaments, signed this petition that is calling for putting a stop to any attempt to go for annexation. And we need to use this world crisis around annexation as a leaning point for regrouping and re-coordinating a universal struggle to see Palestine finally remove the domination of Israel and begin a new phase of partnership between two equals, two nation states, side by side. And my last point is for our conversation. I think that we should not see a two-state solution as the objective of our work. We should see two-state solution as a corridor to the main objective of peacemaking, and that is reconciliation. There is no reconciliation between a defeated nation and a defeating nation. There is no, it doesn't work like this. In the nature of human beings, it cannot work. You cannot defeat someone and then request reconciliation. We need to be, and we need to allow a generational rehabilitation of the Palestinian society into a normal nationhood without the Israeli domination and interference. And then we can reconcile our issues. We need, first of all, to recognize that our conflict is way beyond a diplomatic setup and settlement. The idea that once you get a settlement signed, beyond of that, this is the threshold for peace and partnership. No, that is just the beginning of the hard work of reconciliation. And I think that the idea of annexation is in itself alarming, but it is also an opportunity now to set back our resources into action against occupation and for independent Palestine alongside Israel in a two-state paradigm.
Thank you so much, Ilan. I'd like to take you on the point of the two-state solution. We in Peace Now are have been active and pushing for a two-state solution for a long time. And during the last few months, since Trump's deal of the century was first declared, we've been hearing that this is actually a two-state solution because it offers a Palestinian state. And I know that I'm having a really hard time to explain here in Israel how comes this is not actually a peace plan and why the Palestinians wouldn't even be willing to respond to it. So I'd like Ambassador Zomlot to clarify a bit why this is not a plan for the establishment of a Palestinian state, or is it? And how comes there is no Palestinian partner around the table. Can you please answer that?
It isn't a plan, and it definitely has nothing to do with peace, Shaked. And it is far away from two-state solution. Go back and read the text of this so-called plan. Read the first few pages. The rest is just filling. The first part, it tells you that international law, international resolutions are irrelevant. I need to say this, Shaked, to you and to your audience now. It was international.
I'm playing devil advocate here, right? I know why it's not a people. That is why we're pushing here. But I really want to hear it from a Palestinian representative so I can quote you later on.
No, of course. Go ahead and quote me. So the first part of that so-called ultimate deal, it is not ultimate and it has nothing to do with deals, is that international law, international order is irrelevant. When in fact it was the international order that created Israel. So by making it irrelevant, then Israel and those who really want to see the first Israel need to be absolutely worried. And it was the international order that required upon us, the Palestinian people, the Palestinian leadership, the PLO, to accept the two-state solution. This is very important. I've been saying it recently. The two-state solution was never a Palestinian demand. Let me remind our friends in this conversation. Prior to 1988, the PLO platform, political platform, was one state of Palestine from the river to the sea. Upon the pressure of the international legitimacy, the PLO accepted the premise of the two-state solution, the UN Security Council resolution. So you can call the two-state solution from a Palestinian perspective a concession towards peace. And since then, our late president, Yasser Arafat, recognized the state of Israel on the 1967 borders. So attacking that equilibrium, the international law, is not good for us, is not good for Israel, is not good for the concession we made, is not good for the investments we have. So from the first read of this document, you'll know those are just some business dealers who know nothing about Palestine or Israel, let alone peace and peacemaking. The second part of this deal, the second premise is that Israel shall have overall security from the river to the sea. Read it. I think it's item 7. How do you want to have Israel overall security control from the Jordan River, the most eastern border of the supposedly state of Palestine? How do you create a state whereby it just has buffer zones between it and other states by Israeli presence? The idea is not really a state. It's very clear in that document. The idea is a very beautified situation of what Ilan beautifully described, an apartheid. It is a situation of apartheid. Thirdly, the third major premise of this argument, okay, because we have just said that international law is irrelevant, and because we have just said Israel takes the land, by the way, it's clear, they don't word it, Israel takes the land and allow the Palestinians to live in enclaves. I'm quoting Netanyahu here when he was asked 2 weeks ago. Enclaves means pantostans, whatever, choose the term you like. Because of the two things, there is something for the Palestinians in this plan. We have to give them something. And this something is, we give you a bit of cash. Why they will give us a bit of cash? Because they come, all of them, Trump, Kushner, Greenblatt, Friedman, all of the lot come from the real estate business. In the real estate business, somebody gets the property and somebody gets the cash. And I cannot hold myself from laughing because this is exactly what they're thinking about. I interacted with this team for many, many times. I lost count. I must have met them 32 times in the White House with my president, President Abbas, when he would be visiting Washington, when President Trump would visit Palestine, as he did in Beit Lahem in May 2017. And we had numerous interactions with this team. This is the way they think. This is the way they think. They all come from one particular ideological background. They all come from one professional background, which is property dealing. So that's why the whole, let me summarize it for you, Shaked, and it's important, quote me, the whole Trump thing, because it's a thing, it's a disgusting thing. It's not a document, it's a disgusting thing, like him. The Trump thing is simply a document that tells you that Palestinians are not worthy of collective rights, of national rights, of the right of self-determination, of independence and sovereignty, let alone the right of the Palestinian refugees to be resolved fairly and justly in accordance with all the agreements between us. All what they deserve is that we may improve their livelihoods and living conditions under occupation. We will maintain the slave-master relationship in the historic land of Palestine. And that's why we have rejected this whole thing from its entirety. And that's why Kushner went to Bahrain with his first leg of the plan about, you know, announcing $50 million for Palestinians. This is where I'm going to end. We know exactly what is the Palestinian cause. The Palestinian cause belongs to a nation that is very vivid, very rooted, very talented, very mobilized. The 13 million Palestinians rejected the Trump plan. You have not heard one Palestinian who might have been drugged or something accepting it. We are united in our purpose, in our narrative. Elam talking about Netanyahu's obsession with our narrative. Let him obsess as much as he wants. Our narrative is not going to be unchanged. It will only be solidified with our new generations. Such a nation has its allies, real allies and solidarity in the region. And don't listen to Netanyahu about normalization. He has a couple of friends here and there, but the Arab world, the Arab streets, look at them, hear them very, very clearly. See every time they take off to the streets, as they did recently in Lebanon, in Tunisia, and everywhere. You will see only the Lebanese flag and the Palestinian flag. In Tunisia, the discussion about the constitution, they were introducing a section on Palestine. And Israel is absolutely the one thing that should never be normalized until. There is no such a thing in the world that you introduce in your constitution foreign policy issues. It's always about internal. So we have support in the region no matter what. This support is historic, has to do with the religion, the history, the civilization, the kinship. We are intermarrying, and no Palestinian family has no Jordanians, and Jordanian have Palestinians. This is beyond politics. So Netanyahu can inflate and exaggerate this for his purposes, but he's lying. The third, we do have a serious international support. And thanks to Netanyahu in the last few months particularly, this international support has been magnified, has been multiplied. He has brought back the issue of Palestine to the fore when we have suffered in the last few years of some sort of marginalization because of other issues in the Middle East, other issues worldwide, the coronavirus, etc. And all of a sudden, he has made us all busy, like you, Chicken, and like all the people in this webinar, we are coming together. We saw the demonstration in Tel Aviv. This is very important, what happened, extremely important. We followed the letters by some members of the Knesset, by some Israeli former security personnel. We follow the Jewish community, real activism in the US, here in Europe. By the way, the letter you just mentioned by 1,080 parliamentarians, European parliamentarians, including 260 UK parliamentarians, was initiated by progressive Jewish organizations in Europe and in Israel. So we see this movement together. Why I'm saying all this? Short of Israel and with it, Trump understand that this issue is an issue of nationhood, statehood, self-determination, legitimate rights, people who really want to achieve peace through achieving their rights. Short of that, no real estate business is going to do. And let me, I'm sorry, I've taken a bit longer. Netanyahu has a feel now. It's not just ideology, Ilan. I respect that, you know, he's also a calculator. And he's a maneuverist. He has been maneuvering everywhere. He calculates. It's a cost-benefit for him. And I assure you, the moment he learns that it costs him personally more than it reaps, more than it benefits, he will change course. Of course, he has ideologies. But the main thing for him is what keeps him in power, what advances him as the king of Israel. However, the key really point here is that he feels what we call in strategy power surplus or excess of power, that Israel has such power surplus. This power surplus is because of the military supremacy, the economic supremacy, the relationship with the US, etc., etc. The Arab world and what happened since the Arab Spring, between two parentheses, there is such a surplus. Israel is so comfortable. Add to that there is the Palestinian Authority, it's taking care of the entire occupied population. It's a five-star occupation. Israel can do as it wishes, no international consequences. This is exactly what I mean by power surplus. We are comfortable. But I know, you know, I tell you, this power surplus in the 90s has made Israel want to impose a solution on us. So the idea in the 90s is that let's impose a solution to the interest of Israel, to the benefit of Israel, advantaging Israel because of the power surplus. It didn't work. The 90s didn't work because, as Ilan said, you cannot impose a solution. As actually the UK foreign minister, minister of the Middle East yesterday, the Security Council, he said, imposed peace doesn't work. You can't. In the 2000s, Israel kept the surplus. It increased a little bit in, from 2000 to 2010. In that decade, the surplus increased and it wanted to manage the conflict. So just, it's a conflict management. Netanyahu lately feels so much the power of the surplus and he wants to liquidate the conflict. He wants to redefine the conflict from a conflict of national movements, conflict of political and legal manifestations, and considerations and frameworks to living conditions. People who are poor, we have sympathy to the Palestinians, we want to give them job. Excuse me? The Palestinian people, and I'm not saying this in any way or form just to be rhetorical, we are one of the richest in the region. We have the highest per capita PhD graduates worldwide. Leave us alone and end the occupation and create a state of peace and see the blast that will happen in the economic sense in the Palestinian people. So this will be rejected. And I think Netanyahu is helping us creating a real momentum to a real peace.
Thank you so much, Ambassador Zomlot. I'd like to move now to some questions because we have many. And I'm giving you now I'm suggesting that we extend this session a bit because we have so many questions and we'd like to answer as many as possible. So I'd like to ask both speakers to try and make it short. And I first want to say that I really identify with the intensity that this situation is throwing us, the Israeli peace camp, into. We are working days and nights to figure out how to stop this really, really risky road to apartheid. And I'm continuing from here to Lawrence Joffe, from Meretz UK, who's asking both speakers. He wants to know, in practical terms, how should supporters of peace and two states respond in a post-annexation reality? Would carrots or sticks work better? Should diaspora Jews and Palestinians work together or separately? And he also is thanking for this valuable discussion. I join him. And I'd like Ilan Baruch to answer this. Carrots or sticks, how do we deal with potential apartheid situation? And so on.
This is an issue that we are wrestling with now on a daily basis because talking to Europeans, they ask us, so what do you want us to do? We say disincentives. We say incentives, disincentives. Europe, if you schematically speaking, so far we have had two protagonists. The Americans were playing facilitators. In the negotiations room, there were two parties unequal in when it comes to access of force, as Hussam was explaining to us. So one party had nothing to offer, Palestine. One party did not want to be there in the negotiations room in the first place, Israel. And the Europeans were sitting outside waiting for the white smoke to come out with bags full of incentives. And little did they know that nothing is happening in the room. And I think that, schematically speaking, we need to revisit. We have to have, first of all, in my view, Palestine needs to be recognized as a state so that it gains at least parity of esteem to enter the negotiations room. And secondly, we should forget about facilitation. It's not about offering tea or coffee. It is about delivering substance for the negotiations. And I think that the international community sitting outside needs to be having with it incentives for the two parties to make that necessary compromise, but at the same time disincentives to the two parties if they are not making the necessary compromise for a deal to be struck. And so far, Israel was entertaining a privileged position of no disincentives. And I think this needs to change. But I can tell you, Israelis are very keen to realize that they are being accepted on a friendly turf overseas, and any criticism about Israel overseas is taken very seriously in Israel. And I think that Europe primarily, but also in the United States, a criticism of Israel was restrained for reasons that have nothing to do with Palestine, but had to do much with the history of Jews in Europe, the Holocaust, and so on. There's a lot of guilt involved here, and I think that we need to move forward. I don't think that the Europeans need to give up on their sense of commitment to the Jewish people, but they need to distinguish between the Jewish people and the government of Israel. And I think they need to unleash a far more critical stand on the policies pursued by the government of Israel, because these policies are immoral and unsustainable and threatening international interests just as well.
Thank you. I want Dr. Zomlot to answer this and as well address a question by dear Aviva Meyer, Vice President of APN Board, who asks about poll by Dr. Professor Khalil Shikaki that was published in Israel Hayom that says that 60% of Palestinians are indifferent to the call of the Palestinian Authority against the annexation plan. And is this reality implicating the future in any way? And is it possible what an international approach can change in this reality?
Thank you. Thank you, Shakira. Let me answer Lawrence first, and may I also thank Lawrence for helping arranging this webinar and this very timely discussion, Meretz UK. And answering your question, Lawrence, I have two points really to suggest, because so many things need to happen to help out here. So many things nationally, so many things regionally, so many things globally, European Union, the UK, in the US. But I want to focus for the purpose of this discussion on two things. The first, I think this whole threat of annexation must redraw the lines now. This isn't about people who are pro-Israel and people who are pro-Palestine anymore. I think there has to be a movement, a global movement, versus this fascist, phobic global movement as well. We need to come together and we need to fight everywhere. It's not just against Netanyahu. I mean, Netanyahu is allying himself with you know who. He's the ally of Trump. He's the ally of Bolsonaro. He's the ally of Orban, of Hungary. And should I go on the list? I shouldn't. I hold official position and I should refrain from going down the list. And it's very clear. He has made a bet that he wants to ally with the far right movement worldwide. It's a phobic right movement. And by the way, this movement hates the Muslims and hates the Jews and hates the Sikhs and hates anybody who's the other. And that's why it has to bring us together. It has to bring a movement together. And I invite you, Lawrence, to continue what you're doing. And I urge that we actually start thinking not in terms of ethnicities and color, and in terms of principles, of values. What are the values that could bring us together? And I think we share these values. And these values are not just, you know, values exclusive to a certain nation or a certain group or a certain political party. These are universal values. And they are not even to one religion. These great human values are the values of the Jewish faith, the Islamic faith, the Christian faith. And I think the crux of these values is the values of equality, the values of freedom, the values of justice in all religions, in all cultures, in all ideologies. So I think it's an invitation. This annexation threat and what is happening around us is an invitation for a global movement that should come together from all walks of life to actually defend our principles and our values. The second point I want to make is the how crucial the Jewish communities and the outside is in this equation. The Jewish communities in the US, in Europe and elsewhere has been monumental in its support to Israel. It has been a key pillar upon which Israel has relied for all these years, in the strategic sense, military, economic, political, legal, what have you. It's not a secret. But this is a time when the Jewish community, and we are seeing great deal of traffic, lots of opposition. Here in the UK, the Jewish community is writing letters in the public opposing the annexations. They even wrote a letter to ask the UK government not to accept the proposed Israeli ambassador to the UK because of her background, and she's the Minister of Settlement as we speak. But more could be done, because the alliance now of Netanyahu is not even with the Jewish community. The real alliance of Netanyahu, especially in the US, is with the evangelical movement. And I don't need to stick my neck too much now and tell you what the evangelical movement ultimately believe. It's scary. If I was an Israeli, I would be absolutely scared, unhappy about this. In effect, there is an abandonment of the relationship with the Jewish, especially the progressive voices, and an increased alignment with this right-wing worldview of, you know, we are first, the others are unaccepted, and we will just brush them aside. And the Jewish community, in my opinion, outside, could be it. Because of the connection to the issue, because of the moral background. We know 70% of the Jewish community in the US are Democrats, are liberals, are progressive. They vote Democrats regardless who's the candidate. We know that the Jewish community in America was one of the founders of the the anti-war movement and supported the civil rights movement. We saw the viciousness of the extreme right wing and the white supremacists against the Jewish communities in the US and the synagogues. We know what is happening is not just against the Palestinians, it's against the Jewish communities in America. We find ourselves in the same trench all of a sudden, in the very same trench, and up against the same hostile ideologies and hostile actors. Us and the Jewish communities outside. And by the way, let me go on and brag about it. If you look in the US, who are the most adamant voices for Palestine in the US? They're all Jews supporting the Palestinian cause. I don't want to embarrass them or reveal too much, but all of them. So there is already an existing phenomenon there, but that phenomenon need to be organized and magnified. And actually come to fruition. The answer from Aviva, the question from Aviva, about Shakaki and the polls. You know, Aviva, this should let me and let you despair that if the poll is correct. And, you know, polls are not always correct. The majority of the Palestinian people want to see an end of Israel's occupation. I assure you that. The majority of the Palestinian people want to see an independent, sovereign, Palestinian state, and they need a state that defends them. I mean, they have enough. They are the ones who need security. It's their sons and daughters that are being killed. It's their land that are being stolen on a daily basis. So a state could be the guarantor, if you may, of the rights. You know, in the last few couple of months of the corona pandemic, I was in London, at least, the only ambassador who could not send our people back home. You know, there were so many people stuck here because I have no airport and I have no national airlines. So people want a state. And the majority of the Palestinian, even political factions, in the PLO and outside, including Hamas, now has the two-state solution as a platform. But the poll that shows you 60% will not go and fight for it should cause or should be a cause of despair for you and I. It means people have lost hope. It means that people are not really believing that whatever they can do or will do will change the calculus in Israel. It means that people will fight for their rights, but they will not, you know, not necessarily for some sort of a solution, which is the two-state solution. This is very worrying. Very worrying. And that's why we say this to the UK here, to the European Union, to our friends in the US, to the international community. I say it every day. Produce hope. Produce hope. Back to what Ellen said. Recognize the state of Palestine. Level the field. Impose. Activate the differentiation between Israel and the settlements, the settlement products. Impose sanctions not to only ostracize or punish, but to say to the people on both sides, you are serious about peace, and peace is possible. So in one sentence, in a nutshell, don't read too much into this, but read one thing. We need to give the people in Palestine a strong shot of optimism and hope, and this is, unfortunately, is diminishing by the day now.
Thank you. I want to take you on the shot of optimism and the need for support abroad and let our audience know, in case you're not aware, that there is in these days a letter led by Americans for Peace Now and Israel Peace Now, which I lead, and together with my partner Hadar Saskin from Americans for Peace Now, we have a joint front, American-Israeli front against annexation, and I really urge the people here to look for it at American for Peace Now site, website, and sign it so that Israelis and Palestinians and the international community and politicians in the USA and in Israel see how big is the opposition among their voters here in Israel and in the USA. And this was the shot of optimism that we need to give, but I'll allow myself to take you on another round of pessimism. And I want to ask... I want to ask you a pessimist question. Will you allow me?
Yes, so
I have a question here by Howard Mintz, who is asking about the citizenship status of the people who live in annexed East Jerusalem. And it's an opportunity to say that there was already an annexation that took place in Israel, in East Jerusalem. And I'd call the situation there apartheid-like, and you may elaborate a bit, but just a bit because we don't have much time. And the international community is quite silent about that. And I'd like you to address that issue and maybe say how it projects on the future of a post-annexation situation.
Yes, first of all, I need to react to the question by Aviva, I think, about Israel Hayom. And taking from Khalil Shikaki's poll survey, our listeners need to know that Israel Hayom is not just a paper, it is a tabloid in the service of Netanyahu. And much of what is printed there has no value when it comes to journalism. It's a sort of a propaganda bulletin. It is circulated for free on the streets, and people line up to pick it, and it has no value. Secondly, the same Shikaki survey was also detecting a growing impatience with the situation in light of the plans for annexation and support for armed struggle against it. So if we are going to annexation, we might find ourselves facing a new intifada. And this needs to be calculated into what we think of annexation. Of course, Israeli Yom readers think that annexation will be welcomed by Palestinians and by Arab countries and governments. And that is what Netanyahu wants to portray. And that everything is normal and annexation leads to peace. But we need to be more critical in reading our materials. About Jerusalem. Jerusalem is a case that will have to be studied in light of the intention of my government to create a new community in the West Bank that is becoming people living within Israeli territory without Israeli citizenship, without the right to vote for the Knesset. Netanyahu already made clear in a response to a question in an interview that the Palestinians living in the Jordan Valley and in the territory intended for annexation, we estimated about 60,000 to 80,000 people will have no citizenship in Israel. This would be, of course, apartheid. What is apartheid, if not two sets of a legal definition of citizenship? In Jerusalem, we already have a similar situation, and the only reason why it is tolerated by many is that it is perceived as an interim situation that is to be solved through negotiations of core issues. Jerusalem is one of them, and so the issue will be settled. I think that Jerusalem is a good case for us to study what can happen with annexation, because Israel in 67 annexed Jerusalem, and in 1980 came out with a basic law, Jerusalem united and under Israeli sovereignty and the capital of Israel. And the world reacted to it in a way that I hope will be a leading example for reaction today in case there is annexation, because there was a Security Council resolution, 478, that declared this decision to annex Jerusalem null and void, and demanded action against this. The few countries that had embassies in Jerusalem at the time were requested to remove the embassies to Tel Aviv, and this actually really happened. We are in a different situation. 40 years have passed, and we need to reinvigorate our struggle against annexation, not only new annexation, but also the annexation in Jerusalem needs to be targeted by us, by the Palestinians, by the international community.
Thank you, Ilan. I am going to give one last question because we're close to the end, unless it's short, and then I'll have time for another one. This is a very practical question that is sent to us by Rafael Cohen Almagor to Ambassador Zomlot, and he is asking, is the Palestinian Authority willing to negotiate with Netanyahu? If not, why? I can tell you that personally I've heard President Abbas saying that he's offered a few times to negotiate with Netanyahu, but I'd like to hear, it was 2 years ago almost, and maybe there is a new position. And if there is a need for mediation, who can mediate between the two parties? And I personally, as an Israeli who sees Benny Gantz, or used to see Benny Gantz, as a potential next prime minister in Israel, what does it take for the Palestinian Authority to negotiate with Benny Gantz, and who can mediate that? Can you please answer that, Ambassador Zomlot?
Yes, I can. Let me go back to the question by Howard about the apartheid, because it's a very important question. And I think apartheid has existed for a long time. And Ilan is absolutely accurate in saying apartheid is about erecting two different separate legal systems in one territory operated by one government. This is the UN definition of apartheid. In Israel, there are three separate legal systems that has been operated for decades. The first has to do with the Israeli Jews. As you know, it's semi-democratic. It has all the needed social welfare state, democratic institutions, and what have you. The second is for the Israeli, the Palestinian citizens of Israel, which, you know, the nation state law has specifically told them that they are not really full citizens and they can never have collective rights or the right of self-determination. So that's a different legal system for them by law, by the law of the Knesset. The third system is for the Palestinians under occupation, you know, in the West Bank and Gaza. And in this third system, there are four subsystems. One that has to do with the West Bank, one that has to do with Jerusalemites, Palestinians in East Jerusalem. By the way, there are different legal systems, legal dealings, color of IDs, way of dealing between Israel and these citizens. There are the third category, the people in Gaza, which is the worst category. You don't want to be from Gaza and dealing with the Israeli legal system vis-a-vis Gaza. You are besieged, you are in an open-air prison, as you know. And the fourth is for Palestinian exiled diaspora, refugees outside, which in no way allow them to even visit, let alone return. Now, this has been happening for a long time. The question is, why, if it was happening, this issue was not magnified? Why there is no light being shed on this apartheid? Why we are not talking about it as much? I'll tell you why. Because during that time, there was focus on the two-state solution. Focus on the issue of land liberation, end of occupation, establishing two sovereign states. Focus on international mediation, back to your question, and Rafael, about who can mediate. And everybody was waiting and hoping against hope and wanting to see what will happen in the Israeli elections and what will happen in the American elections. This lasted for 27 years. This brings me back to my first assessment. Should Netanyahu goes ahead with the annexation, I think the talk about apartheid would take the center stage in the Palestinian national politics, in our global movement, and what have you. It is very important to explain that. And by the way, this is not by way of telling Israel you may lose out of this. This is the reality for many of us, like including myself. We chose to focus on creating a state, ending Israel's occupation, achieving our sacred national rights. We chose to focus on this. We chose to almost turn the other way and the other side, hoping that this process will lead to actually that direction. Now that with annexation, and by the way, should the annexation happen, when we are talking about recognition of the state, sanctions, we talk about preemptive action steps to prevent. We are now in the prevention arena. And by the way, we are very hopeful. I mean, there is enough accumulated snowball that is happening worldwide. We must prevent annexation, because should annexation happen, it's a new chapter, new territory, new terrain, new arena. God knows, God, only God will know what will happen after annexation. But for the time being, our focus should be on preventing annexation. Is the PA, the PA does not negotiate, Rafael. Let me explain this. Only the PLO negotiates. Only the Palestine Liberation Organization has the legitimacy and the mandate by all the Palestinian factions that have been elected by their constituencies to negotiate on behalf of the Palestinian people. And by the way, even Hamas said that we are fine with the PLO negotiating on behalf of the Palestinians under one condition: any agreement has to be offered for a national referendum, which something we could arrange is not an impossible. So it is the PLO. Is the PLO willing to negotiate with Netanyahu? Is the PLO willing to negotiate with Gantz? I don't think this is about personalities, Shaki. This is not about the person at the helm of Israeli power, the helm of Israeli government. It could be anybody. This is about the fundamentals, the fundamentals. We engaged the government of Rabin in 1993 because we saw that the fundamentals were there. The international framework was in the Declaration of the Principles, 242338, UN Security Council resolutions. All the issues that should be final status issues were listed clearly, which indicated Rabin's government acceptance to reverse even the annexation of Jerusalem, because once you put Jerusalem as number one issue to be negotiated, then you accept the premise that your annexation was illegal, was null and void. Today, we will sit with any Israeli leader, representative, prime minister, should these fundamentals be restated and clarified clearly. We are not about who we like and who we dislike. It's about our rights. It's about the possibilities of reaching an agreement. And by the way, we have wasted 27 years. I'm not so sure if we are interested to waste another 27 years. Having said that, yes, President Abbas has been saying he is willing to meet any Israeli prime minister under the international framework, under a mechanism of an international peacemaking. He is willing to meet any Israeli leader, but not in Washington, because the Trump administration cannot be a fair and trusted mediator. And this tells you that we are more interested in creating positive outcome than we are interested in only expanding the situation. We want to go in the direction of a peaceful negotiations that end the conflict. But the key here is fundamentals. And I personally don't think that Netanyahu is capable to produce any fundamentals. He has spent the last so many years, since 1996. Remember, he was elected in 1996, shortly after the assassination of Prime Minister Rabin, on one ticket, to derail everything and to dismantle these bases and fundamentals. And I must give him credit. He has been very successful so far.
Yes, sure. His slogan in 96 used to be, "We're making a safe peace." And from then till now, we see the peace and prosperity plan by Trump. They keep misusing the word peace so that they can cover up for their de facto annexation. And I have to sum up this discussion because we're already prolonging it. So I'll just ask the two of you for final remarks. And I'd like you to address the issue of de facto annexation, because as a movement in Israel Peace Now that is tracking and monitoring the expansion of settlements, I can tell you that de facto annexation is a phenomenon that has been happening for the last decade in a speedy version, and from the moment that Trump was elected even more faster. So first, if annexation is stopped, what do we have to do to stop the de facto annexation? Because it might seem to the international community and to Israelis and Palestinians that the threat is over. But then if settlements are still constructed, then we are facing the same problem, but not formally admitting it. And some people here asked, isn't it even better to declare this is what Israel really wants, the jure annexation and not only the de facto one? I'd like you to include that in your final remarks. And then I'll thank you and we'll call it a night. So please, Mr. Baruch, your closing remarks.
Yes, annexation was folded into occupation since day one. And now Netanyahu is taking it out from the embryonic stage into daylight. It is a threat, but it is also an opportunity, because it has been so far proving to be a a recruiting argument that we need to stand up to annexation and work together to remove it from the agenda. But we should not be satisfied with shelving the annexation for the time being, because this will put it back into the embryonic stage of annexation that exists in occupation. We need to use it to regroup and reinvigorate the fight against the occupation and put together the alliance of players in Palestine, in Israel, and overseas. And I see here a potential for a lot of work to be done. And I want to tell people it's not the moment for desperation or a sense of defeat for us leftists, pro-peace. It is a moment for regrouping and putting our energies together into a fight against it. And I'm very inspired by the presentation of Ambassador Zomblot, and I'm hoping very much to have an opportunity to meet with him, not on the web, and in person, and see in what way we can work together. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ilan, and thank you for your efforts on your side to bring us to a better future. Yes, please, Ambassador Zomlot, your closing remarks. By the way, I said before, call it a night, because here in Israel, it's almost 9 p.m., but I know that in the U.S. you still have a lot to do today to stop annexation, so go on. And yes, sorry, Dr. Zomlot, the mic is yours.
Well, about first, about your question regarding de facto annexation versus de jure. Well, we've never seen that as a de facto annexation. We saw throughout the so-called peace process, I mean, the Oslo period, Israel has agreed to define its presence in the occupied territories, in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and in Gaza as temporary. It agreed. You know, go back. It doesn't matter how much they market it, how they brand it. It was agreed that their presence is temporary. And the Oslo process was a mechanism to actually backroll that temporary occupation and create a permanent situation of two states. Now, what Netanyahu is proposing is turning the temporary into a permanent. It's not about de jure. There's nothing de jure about it. It is turning the situation into permanent. And that's why we will not engage in any peace process that has to do with the two-state solution without reversing all this. The announcement by this government, and this links to Gantz, because he is a key member of this government, is an announcement that reverses Oslo. That's the heart of it, that we don't think our presence inside the 67 borders is temporary. In major parts of it, in the real parts of it, the parts we want and will turn the Palestinian, the possibility of a Palestinian state impossible, these parts are going to be permanent. Source of change, but I leave that for Elise. This is not our issue. The issue here is whole annexation, the Netanyahu affair, it's not primarily about Palestine. You know, we are very clear. And yes, there are some despair, lack of hope, but we've been there before and we are capable to reproduce hope. And I assure you it will be reproduced very soon. We're very clear. We want to end Israel's occupation that began in 1967. I mean, you know, you've heard a million times, but it's good to be clear. It's good to be straightforward. It's good to know what you want. We want to establish a state on the 1967 borders with East Jerusalem, its capital, not a capital in Jerusalem. East Jerusalem, we want to resolve the issue of refugees in accordance with international legitimacy, resolutions, law, and in accordance with the Arab Peace Initiative. And we understand we must negotiate these matters. We also know that this cannot be achieved now via Washington, but we are hoping that there will be an international snowball, the Quartet Plus. We add to them the, you know, other major actors in the Arab world, and we are pushing in the direction of international mechanism. And if all this fails, also Palestine is very clear. I mean, I'm sorry, this is not about demography, but Israel is so insisting on fragmenting the geography, in swallowing the geography. Gaza has been carved, 2 million people in an open air prison. Jerusalem has been ransacked. The people's homes have been demolished. They are subjected to the most horrific situation. The West Bank's land has been eaten fastly in a vast, cancerous way over the last so many years. And you know that, Shakir, you're watching and following, and I read your reports. So the geography has been so fragmented. But we have the demography, the Palestinian people. They are not fragmented. And you know, we are 6.7 million Palestinians, Muslims and Christians, now in the land of historic Palestine, from the river to the Jordan. And I don't like the argument about demography being a threat. Human beings are not a threat. But we are there, and we have sustained and withstood the pressure and the conspiracies and the wars and the ethnic cleansing and all that happened and all that is happening. And you know, there are 6.5 Israeli Jews now in the same area. So in terms of demography, we know that we are there. And I didn't even mention the 6.5 million Palestinians who live outside, the refugees in the diaspora. We are ain't going anywhere. This isn't about Palestine. This is about Israel, how it wants to define itself, for the region, and for the international community. This is about, Israel wants to be defined as the oppressor and the aggressor, permanent. Israel wants to continue being defined as the last country in this world that still deploys policies of colonization. I mean, we're done with that in the 40s. Colonization, military occupation, apartheid, besiegement. I mean, it's sick. I don't think really the average Israeli people want to be defined in this case. And it is also an issue that has to do with what kind of international system, what kind of world, what kind of world. Do we want a rules-based international system, or do we want chaos? And we want we want the rule of the jungle. Because you know what, Shakir and all my friends, this isn't only about Netanyahu. It's going to be about who's next. And this isn't only about Israel-Palestine. Who's going to be next and next and next? So this is a moment that we feel empowered. And I link back to Ilan's final remarks about hope. By the way, I am so hopeful, and I'll leak for you a secret. Whenever I have a genuine, frank conversation and I reveal myself with any Palestinian colleagues, friends of mine back home, I say, you know, Netanyahu, because he's drunken with power, is in the end serving our cause. Look at us now. We almost went away in the last few years, and now we are back, and there is this kick-in feeling in our guts, in your guts. We want to do something, and I think this coming together is much bigger in numbers, is much bigger in values and principles, is much closer to international equilibrium and principles. And I think in the end, Netanyahu can have his moment under the sun with four people. Four. Trump, Kushner, Friedman, I have to be polite. And Avi, you know, the new guy after
Berkovich.
Yes, Berkovich, that's the guy. Four. But I tell you, 100%, we have the rest. We have the rest of the world. And we are less organized. We don't have the power. But it's a matter of when, not if. It's a matter of time. So thank you very much for having this conversation. And allow me to say that we are partners in the path toward ending this and defeating those people who don't want to make us believe that there is a better tomorrow. I believe there is a better tomorrow. I believe there is an existing, and it will always remain, possibility of really achieving peace, of seriously living together, of actually engaging in a dynamic that will get the best out of us. Imagine a situation when we can move freely, when we can work freely, when we can travel freely. I mean, the merge, the partnership would be huge. Israel is one of the most high-tech countries, very well connected to the West. we have the most educated, the youngest, and very well connected to the East. The partnership will produce a blast, but we have to defeat the sick, the maximalists, the ones who think they can have the cake and eat it too, the ones who want to create a political momentum only at the skulls of our dreams. And I think their time is about to be up.
Thank you, Hussam, for your empowering statements. I think you summarized the Israeli peace camp position as well. This is not Israel's interest to occupy or to annex or to oppress the Palestinian people in any way. And I truly believe that most Israelis, when asked, agree with us, agree with what you said. And I must tell you, our dear audience, before I close this discussion and give the microphone to our hosts, that I personally see this huge crisis as a huge opportunity. I think that it's time for us to bring the political issue and the conflict resolution front and center to the Israeli and international discussion. And it's our job to show an alternative and to keep the hope for an authentic peace, as you just described, instead of constant conflict and oppression, as Trump and Netanyahu are suggesting, only, if I may say, to protect themselves from being kicked away from their power positions. And we will kick them away eventually, if I may also say. And with this final remarks, I'd like to say thank you to our hosts and give Lenny from Partners for Progressive Israel, Israel, yes, to say goodbye.
Thanks to you, Shaked, for your moderating and you know, your organization. We have your sister organization, Americans for Peace Now, is a co-sponsor. And our partners in the 10-member Progressive Israel Network. And thanks to Meretz UK for co-sponsoring. Thanks, of course, to our two speakers, to Ilan Baruch and Hussam Somlat. Your words were important, instructive, inspiring, and they leave us with some hope and urgency to continue working for the just cause. Anyone who wants to learn more about what Partners for Progressive Israel is doing with its Stop Annexation campaign, please come to our website. Thanks to all of you for joining us, and stay safe.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. See you soon again.